Anything else I can get you?
I needed this. I mean,
you're struggling today?
No, I'm not struggling, but I just...
It's half a cup. I only had time...
my kids out of the house. I didn't have as much as I normally would.
How are the boys
and
this
I figured
morning?
You were going to grill me, so I needed to be on my game here.
Yeah, we didn't pre-interview. I didn't ask Chris, like, what's on or off the table, so I can guarantee I'm going to ask a few questions that... that he's not going to like or refuse to answer. Give me that runaround. We're going to take a break here because so we build in more time at 20 so you can just chill for a little bit, have your coffee. How are you? Chris Maddie from Koskoff, Koskoff and Beater. You good?
Good, buddy. Good to see you.
Happy Monday. The boys are good?
Everybody's good.
All right. So now you get another big decision done. That's the last question I have before we break. Like, are you chilling again or are you cranking on other stuff? Like, is this case, we'll talk about this a little more, but just the question is this case still going to, is there a ton of stuff left?
We are so close to the finish line, at least for our part here in Connecticut, but we are not quite done yet.
Right. We'll talk about that more. Chris Maddie, Koskoff, Koskoff, and Beater. I was here on Thursday at former Hartford Mayor Luke Bronin in studio when I was able to divulge the news about this deal where the Onion, supported by some of the Sandy Hook families, won the auction, and they were going to effectively shut down InfoWars. Am I characterizing that properly?
Yeah, it's complicated, but that's a simple way to put it. Yeah,
I'm a simple man, but when I sat and thought about it, I mean, this was all orchestrated, right? I mean, was that actually the highest bid?
Yes.
Come on, really?
Oh yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, so here's how this works. The court-appointed trustee is responsible for liquidating all of Alex Jones's assets so that it can be turned into cash to be distributed to the people that he owes money to, the Sandy Hook
firm. So the law firm itself has nothing to do with the decision on who wins or doesn't win?
No. It's entirely determined by the trustee, who has a fiduciary obligation to all the creditors to maximize value for the creditors. And so... Jones, as the 100% owner of InfoWars, had to have the business sold off. And so the trustee held an auction pursuant to an order entered by the court. And we didn't know who else was participating, but the Onion was interested in purchasing the assets.
You didn't approach them with the idea. This emerged organically?
Yeah, the Onion approached us. I mean, as any, I think, good faith buyer would want to, right? Because unless you're aligned with Alex Jones, because, you know, we would have an opportunity to object if somebody won the auction who we felt wasn't going to maximize value for the estate. And so I think that was prudent for the Onion to do. And obviously, our goal from the very beginning has been, number one, to get maximum accountability of Alex Jones, and number two, to prevent him from hurting other people. So it was very important to us that he would be deprived of this infrastructure that he's had to hurt so many.
And so the concept of the Sandy Hook families putting in their own money, that just came out of the conversations? Because it seems weird to me, and first of all, I think it happened organically. It's kind of, if you want to see justice in a certain way, it's kind of a brilliant thing that happened. But I'm curious. It's like, if I'm a Sandy Hook family, I put $1 million into it, I'm going to get that million back.
That's not quite how it works. So what we did was we determined that if necessary, the Sandy Hook families in Connecticut, and only in Connecticut, would waive a certain portion of the auction proceeds that they were entitled to. And the reason that they would do that is because there are other creditors. There are families in Texas, and we would want to make sure that they were as well off under any bid as they would be under the Onion's bid. And because we hold $1.4 billion, we were able to do that. So this isn't a situation where the families we represent are putting their own money into. The contrary, they're waiving. And I think this is... testament to the kind of people that they are. They're waiving their interest in these auction proceeds, taking less money
it sounded like some of the families put in money to the bid.
No.
It was all the Onion's money.
But by waiving our interest in certain proceeds, we boosted the strength of
Correct.
That bid.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's fast because it was too I don't want to say cute, but it was too dripping with irony for me to think that that would happen organically. But you're telling me that they came to you and it just emerged? Because, I mean, the fact that the Onion won it is kind of amazing.
Anybody could have participated.
I understand, but the fact that they did it and won it is amazing. Because, like, what they represent, what they do, you know, I mean, it's... I mean, if people don't know, I mean, most people do, but it's a satirical website. Well, actually, you don't even need to read the articles. The headlines are good and nothing else really matters. It's just like, it's really, they've made a business out of satirical headlines. I mean, that's basically what it was. So anything else that people would need to know about what happened? Because now they're going to shut it down, but maybe come back as a satirical thing. But for all intents and purposes, the brand InfoWars is never going to come back in a serious way.
Well, the court still has to approve this sale. So all that's happened so far is that the trustee has determined that the Onion is the winning bid. And then all of the information relating to the process and the bids that were submitted will be presented to the court next week, probably. And the court will decide, you know, whether or not the trustee, in exercising his business judgment, determined properly that the Onion was the best bidder. We expect that to be the case. And then at that point, you know, all of the title and all of the products and all of the studio equipment will transfer to the control of the Onion. It's currently under the control of the trustee. And if that happens, then yeah, InfoWars will be no more.
Now, what about all the stuff that Alex Jones is saying about this? Does anything that he says have any standing? Is there an appeal process? Is there anything he can do in terms of an injunction or anything like that?
Well, I mean, I think it's clear now that that he had a straw bidder who he was working with who lost. And so I expect that they will object next week to the sale. But really, the trustee has such broad discretion to determine what's in the best interest of the creditors. And I should say, you know, as the attorney for the Sandy Hook families in Connecticut who own 90%+ of the claims against InfoWars, this is a result that we feel is in our best interest.
Now, just to clarify for me, there are, because I don't know the case as well as you, obviously, there are some families that lived in Newtown that moved to Texas that are involved in the case. Is that it?
There are two couples, both of whom lost children at Sandy Hook, who brought suit in Texas.
Okay.
Two of them tried their case. Two of them have not, but they're creditors of Alex Jones as well. And so, you know, they have an interest, obviously, in the outcome of this as well.
So Chris Matty from Koskoff, Koskoff & Beter, joining us here on Brian & Company. The question then is, say everything works in your best interest and the Onion, the bid is approved and accepted and it all goes through, is that close the book here? Because there's still all that money he technically owes, so I don't know.
So remember, the auction itself generates some proceeds for the families, but there are other assets as well. For example, the sale of his vacation home, the sale of his ranch, the sale of his personal property, all the cash balances in Free Speech Systems, all of that is being collected by the trustee for distribution to the families. And then beyond that, because the court determined that he had acted with such malice in publishing these false statements about these families that he can't get out of this in bankruptcy. So all of his future income is subject to collection as well up until the time he pays $1.4 billion. So whatever he decides to do next, whether it's, you know, somebody puts a microphone in front of him in his basement or he's mowing lawns, that cash is coming to
the family. There'll be something related to these families, your suit, and him as long as he's on earth.
Fortunately, that's not something that I'll be involved with. I'm not a collections lawyer in Texas. Somebody else will be doing that. But yeah, this debt will be paid to the maximum extent he can.
I have a quick question before we take a break, because I I'm not a lawyer. Do they make stipulations so he can like live his life? Like how does that work?
Yeah, we don't have debtor's prison in the United States, and I think that's a good thing. So he will be able to you know, support himself. And in Texas, there's a homestead exemption. So like his personal home.
He gets to keep his house.
But, you know, here's a guy who's shown an ability to generate a lot of personal income in the past, obviously through what I think are nefarious means. But if he continues to generate income, the large majority of that will come to pay the debts.
But who determines like how much he gets to keep and how much has to go to the families?
That's the subject of, you know, collections in Texas.
Okay. We're back here with Chris Matty from Koskoff, Koskoff & Beter. We talked a lot about the Onion's deal to purchase InfoWars and what that means for the families and moving forward. I want to talk politics a little bit because I don't know how you're processing everything that's going on. We don't talk. I mean, you and I didn't talk about any of this off the air. So I don't know where your mind is. But, you know, I've had a ton of conversations. I'm going to have actually later in the week. Nancy DiNardo is going to come on. I'm going to have Ben Proto come on. But I had the same conversation with Luke Bronin and with Sean Scanlon, sort of, who are obviously Democrats, about what they think is going wrong with the Democratic Party. And everyone's been writing these postmortems on the Democratic Party, on what has gone wrong. And I'm just curious about your view now. We have a couple weeks in the rearview mirror about what's happening in our country, what happened on Election Day, and why. Those are massive questions, I understand.
You know, I think that it's worthwhile to remember that this was a very close election, as they all are nowadays.
But it wasn't as close as the last two. He won the popular vote, which he didn't win in the last two, and he also has the Senate and the House. And it was, you know, I mean, it's close relative. It wasn't 55-45, but it was decisive.
Well, you're talking about a difference, I think, in the end of a couple hundred thousand votes out of a country of, 330 million. But your point is correct, which is that it was enough. And there were enough of those kind of very, very small sliver of undecided people, really across every state, it seems, who ended up going with Donald Trump, and that includes in Connecticut, where he made gains really all over the state. Obviously not nearly enough to carry the state, but I think that was true. And what do I attribute it to? I think it's a few things. Number one, Democrats and the president were presiding over an economy that a lot of people, especially working class and poor people, just didn't think was working for them. And you can point to any macroeconomic indicator to say that the United States economy was better than any other economy in the world. But when people are dealing with very high rent costs, higher product costs and household costs than they can swallow, wages, although increasing, not keeping up with those price gains, it just feels really, really hard to a lot of people. It feels really hard.
So then with that saying, you're saying there's nothing the Democrats could have done to win. That was almost a fait accompli because the way the cost of living is in this country right now.
Well, I think all of the economic indicators suggested that it was going to be tough. And then I think when you had, 150 days or whatever to run a campaign after the President Biden dropped out, it made it very difficult. But I think it was still winnable. And my sense is that Vice President Harris and her campaign, although they tried very hard, and my understanding is that the advertising in the swing states did focus on economic issues.
Effective ad probably of all was the "she's for they, them, and I'm for you." I mean, that was not an economic issue ad, and they say that was as effective as anything.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I have a hard time believing that people who are just trying to make ends meet care all that much about those types of issues. I think they care.
But you're right. Listen, kitchen table issues were dominated. I'm not arguing that. I just think that to say that, I think that basically you're saying that the Democrats, everything that they did was good, except that just the economy sunk them. And I don't agree with that.
The bigger problem to me is that there wasn't enough confidence among working people and poor people in the Democratic Party as an institution, that there was goodwill brought up that they would trust us.
Okay, so how do you change that then? Because those are populaces that you've banked on for decades.
Sorry?
Those are groups, like working class Americans when I was younger were Democrats where I grew up.
Correct. I mean, that's what the Democratic Party was. Right. It was the party of working and poor people, and the Republican Party was the party of
the
country
elites.
Clubs and billionaires.
Yeah. Which it still is, but the reputation they've gotten, the coalition Trump talked about was real. He got more people outside of that traditional tent to go and vote Republican.
I mean, don't you think that working people want to see their wages go up? And so what's good there? increased minimum wage. Increased minimum wage passes in every state where there's a referendum on it. It's hugely important. What about the cost of housing? Hugely important. And we've had in our country, and I don't know, this is true in probably every state, we've had housing supplies and difficulty bringing more housing online, right? That could really, really help bring the rent down. But you have to be able to talk to people in a real way that makes them trust you, that you care about how much money's in their bank account, and that you care about how much money they're able to put towards their retirement. And you know, I don't think that Trump is, you know, the most articulate spokesperson on this stuff. I don't think he knows what he's talking about half the time, but at least he's talking to people in a way that they think is real. Now, I got to be honest with you. I don't think we're going to get very far into this administration where it becomes clear that, no, what Trump wants to do is actually going to hurt working people. His most significant economic proposal was across-the-board tariffs on anything that's important in this country. If that happens, people are going to be paying way more than they are right now.
Right. I mean,
he wants to lower taxes for the richest people in the country, which is going to reduce the resources we have available for Medicaid expansion, home care expansion, things like that. So I think that the emperor is going to have no clothes on very soon, but there's going to be a lot of damage, at least in my view, as a Democrat, that he can do in the meantime.
Yeah. Let's continue the conversation here with Chris Matty from Koskov, Koskov and Beter. I mean, the presidential politics stuff, I mean, a lot of people are sort of a little tired of the postmortem. But for me, I want to take a step back for a second. And if you were, instead of anointing Harris as the nominee, the way they pivoted because they thought that was their best chance to win, if they had entered an open convention with multiple people, I mean, would you have said Harris going in would be the person you'd support, or would you wait and see to see what came out of it? And did you favor that option?
I think that that was an option if anybody had wanted to step up. And
but it was not an option because everyone coalesced so quickly behind Harris because Pelosi made everybody that it froze everybody else out. The there was not an open convention. I'm talking like a Lincoln-esque, four people go in with possibilities of being the nominee and one person emerges.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the way I look at it is if there were other people who thought that they could win or they were better candidates, they absolutely...
If Nancy Pelosi gets every single major donor and every single major legislator and Obama to say, we're going to get behind her, who's going to come against that? Nobody did. No, nobody was going to.
The point I'm making is that made her a strong candidate. I mean, there are advantages to having institutional support within the Democratic Party.
But and that
she
made
had
them,
and let me just say, hold on a second. She was the vice president of the United States.
Correct.
So there was a lot of reason to think that she was a leading and highly competent and qualified candidate. And I think that she was. Now, if you're asking me, you know, what would have happened had there been more competition at the convention, I don't know the answer. And if somebody had won over the vice president, whether or not they would have run a better campaign, I don't know the answer. And I don't think it matters. I mean, really, to me, the biggest divide in this election was between people who follow politics closely and people who don't. And if you look at those numbers, people who follow politics closely supported the vice president overwhelmingly. People who don't follow politics, and by the way, I'm not casting judgment on this at all. I think most people are way too busy to do this. And maybe don't vote in off years, but vote in presidential elections, are really thinking about, geez, it's more of a emotionally, how am I doing? How do I think the country's doing? And they're not really paying attention to much more than just
again,
that.
But again, you're saying like no matter who the candidate was, they were going to lose. And I'm just saying that, you know, listen, she wasn't a good candidate in 2020. Before she was anointed the nomination, she was in a lot of ways pushed aside in the administration. And the one thing she's attached to was a disaster, which was the border. And so I guess my point is for you to not think that it was a coordinated effort to make sure that everyone coalesced behind her because the powers that be felt it was the best chance to win. There was nothing open about it, in my opinion. Like, and I don't know how you could see it differently. I mean, there was
when you say coordinated effort, I mean, what you're really talking about are leaders of the Democratic Party
believing
that she would be the best candidate and getting behind her. That is politics. That's a political process. And there were thousands of delegates at the convention who were free to choose whoever.
Wait a second.
You're coming across to me in a way that's like looking at this and her getting the nomination as if it was some kind of undemocratic process.
Correct.
And the reality is that the Democratic Party and all of the delegates went to that convention where she was clearly leading, but where the rules also allowed anybody who wanted to compete with her compete. And you seem to think that the fact that nobody chose to challenge her is some indication that the fix was in, when really what
fix.
It may have
it's
been
not a, I don't call it
is
a
just
fix.
That she was the strongest candidate.
I don't want to bog too down on this because we clearly don't see it the same way. It's not that the fix was in. I think that enough people were convinced that this was the best way to win, so everyone got behind it, which meant like there was no way anyone could counter that momentum. And so you can say, I mean, it's pie in the sky stuff to say people went into the convention with, you know, free will to decide whatever they want, when everyone knew that they were told to go this way and that's what they did. To me, it would have been the best sign of the democracy. And again, I go back to, you know, was the Team of Rivals or whatever, you know, that he went in and there was like at least three other people who were a favorite in front of him, and they went through the process and he emerged, and then he became one of the greatest presidents in the history of the country. And my point is that what better sign, when you're supposedly staring in the face of what some people think is fascism, what better sign of democracy is to have a truly open process and come up with the person who best demonstrates that they're the person at that convention? I'm just saying I would have liked to have seen it. And I think that there were machinations to make sure it didn't happen. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying it was fixed. It was right in front of our face. It wasn't like we were duped. You know what I mean? It just, that's what happened.
Yeah.
I'm not a conservative. I'm an independent. That's the way I view it. I mean, I don't know how you can view it another way, but you can disagree with me, and that's fine.
Well, I just think that there's nothing, when you say machinations, there was, I think, a consensus within the Democratic Party that she would be the strongest candidate.
I think a lot of people thought that, but not enough to get what ended up happening. And I think that, like, Pelosi's a perfect example. I mean, I believe that she made this decision and she got everyone to fall in line because she has those levers. She can do that. And now that obviously, because the decision was so, it didn't work out, it's, I don't think she'll have those levers of power ever again.
Well, I guess the way I look at this is that whole process of the president stepping aside and the Democratic Party coalescing around the vice president, which it seems to me is like what you would expect to happen. And the idea that was kind of not democracy at its best, it is.
I mean,
to
she
me,
didn't get any votes for any. I mean, outside of the. I mean, it's not like she ran for. You know, she did. I mean, that argument, actually, I want to put that aside because I don't think it's a great argument, because she didn't have a chance to run in a primary. So, that in 2024. So I don't mean to interrupt you. Finish your thought.
Well, to me, that seems like small potatoes compared to what we are seeing happening right now, where the president-elect is putting forward somebody who is not at all qualified and was previously the subject of a child sex trafficking investigation in charge of the Justice Department, along with his personal legal team. He's proposing to put somebody in charge of the Department of Health and Human Services who thinks there is no vaccine that is safe for children, even though we've had vaccines in elementary schools, thank God, for years. So you're talking about kind of an internal process that I think played out quite naturally for the selection of Kamala Harris to be the Democratic nominee, when we are staring at what seems to be a consolidation of power in Washington under highly unqualified people whose only characteristic is they're loyal to the president-elect.
We only have a minute and a half. You're right about that. Let's stop that other conversation. What do you think is going to happen? Because, I mean, someone like Gates, even in the Senate that's Republican, maybe they'll strong arm him, but I think this is like this is going to be a test of the separation of powers, because the only way to get them through is through recess appointments.
That's how it seems to me. I mean, it doesn't seem like Gates has the support within the Republican conference to get confirmed.
Because it's embarrassing.
It's beyond embarrassing. I mean, you're talking about a guy who they can't even allow to go through traditional vetting processes because they know what they're going to find. They have a House Ethics Committee report on Matt Gaetz that they are terrified of making public. Why? Because according to reporting yesterday, there was a witness who testified to the committee who observed him in a sexual act with a minor. And this is the guy they want to be Attorney General of the United States. It's horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree. I mean, I want to talk more about that element, the nomination process, because and I wanted to talk about the Department of Government Efficiency too. We got bogged down on the vice the president and the nominee.
You were very.
I didn't agree with you. No, I mean, it's like you're the same thing. It's like when I interrupt you, you're like, let me finish my point. It's like if I don't agree, I have to follow through with it. So we'll have to do it again. Chris Maddie from Koskoff and Beater, you know, and the book. By the way, is Say Nothing a good TV show to watch? Should people watch it?
Yeah, yeah. Do they know that we read the book and now book it's club. Been made into a TV show? That's it for us, I guess.
Yeah, no, you don't have to go right away. But I mean, if I go past 30 seconds, I'll probably get fired. But that's all right.
Yeah.
Chris, it's good to see you as always.
All right, man.